This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Everybody, and welcome to Resolved Mysteries. This is the show where we recap, rewatch, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show, Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And I'm Carlin.
And welcome to the show. So, as many of you know, for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's organization is the Wild Bird Fund, suggested by our patron, Thomas G.
Oh, we love it.
We love it. Carlin or Eliza, would one of you like to shout out some patrons?
Shout out to Heather, Tessa J., Lisa K., Kimberly B., Lauren S., Patron DNH2, Nicole P., Kate T, Bonnie, Robert B, Lori J, Senna or Sina A, and Barbara R.
Yay!
Thank you, honeys.
Little honey buns.
And if you'd like to support us on Patreon, you'll get access to ad-free episodes. Yay! 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, along with goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. Okay. I'm super excited for this episode because I thought it was a really fun one to watch. What are we talking about?
Well, the aliens are coming and...
Did you say the aliens with an S?
Yeah,
the
yes, aliens. We've discussed this before. If any listener can write to us and tell me why I'm saying that, we'll send you a sticker.
Whoa, we'll send you a bunch of stickers.
I don't even know, so exciting.
Ooh. It's a, it's definitely a millennial type reference. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about the unexplained case of the Belgium UFOs. Multiple.
Mm-hmm. So many. And then I'm covering the unexplained death of Robert Hamrick.
And I have the wanted segment looking for Philip Breen.
Ugh.
And before we get started, I have little gifts for my sisters here.
Oh, yay!
And so... Poor Carlin doesn't have her little bag because I forgot to drop it at her door, even though I was just at her door and had the bag in my car. But Allison's going to open it. As many of you know, I recently went to Santa Fe and I visited a special place that we have talked about on the podcast, season 3, episode 10. So Allison, go ahead and open your bag.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait.
Oh, so I have a magnet with my name on it. If you are Allison with one L, you know how rare it is one to find L. your name I correctly know. Spelled on anything.
Yes.
And then I also have the best postcard of a bunch of, what are they, choral singers?
I guess, or the nuns singing.
Are they
I
the
don't
nuns
know.
on the stairs? I love it. Thank you.
You have to explain where it's from.
Okay, so it says Loretto Academy Girls Choir, 1959.
Ah!
And so I went to the Loretto Chapel in Santa Fe, and of course Jesus made it with his donkey, if you recall.
Of course.
And I have to say, the staircase truly in person is crazy.
Oh my gosh.
You cannot believe that one person would make this by hand in the 1800s. It's crazy. Like, the wood on the bottom is so smooth and, like, perfectly bent. I have no idea how that works. And then, of course, like we talked about, there's no support in the middle. So it's roped off. You cannot stand on it. Like, after being there and seeing how protected it is, it's crazy to see. This is what the postcard looks like, Carlin. You have one, too. Ooh. But it's crazy to see a picture of that many people on it after being there because it's scary.
Yeah. There's no support for it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's just, it's so beautiful. And then, Carlin, you don't have to say the name that's on yours, but as many of you can imagine, I was shocked to find an Allison with one L. There's never any way that I can find a Carlin.
No, there's never been one.
And there's never been one in her whole life, but this is the one I got for you, which you don't have to say.
Oh my God, I love it. She got me one with my middle name on it.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a honey.
Eliza, so nice.
Oh my gosh. Oh, and I just, one more thing. So then the chapel is like attached now to this beautiful hotel that has this beautiful courtyard with where we got drinks the morning we left. But then also in the adjoining corner lot, there was this market and people were selling things. And then across the street, this guy was selling jewelry. And I went over there and was looking and he was like, "Have you been into the church yet?" I was like, "Yeah, I just went in." And he said, "That church is the source of all of our blessings in Santa Fe." And so they like really believe it and they love it. It's really sweet. Wow. And he was like a young guy, like 35, you know.
Is the chapel still used as a chapel or is it just?
I don't know for sure, but I don't think so. Yeah, people get married there. You can get married there. But I don't think there's like regular Sunday service. But I could be wrong about that.
Wow.
It's really small, but the outside's beautiful. And
I love so much that you actually went.
Yes. So that's those are little gifties for you. Carlin, I'll get you yours as soon as I can.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Honeys.
All right. Let's talk about more weird things.
Okay, the Belgium UFO is the name of the segment, which doesn't make any sense. It should be Belgian.
Gosh, nothing makes sense, does it?
It just doesn't. Nothing does. And it should be noted that this segment is one entire third of the episode.
It sure is.
It is an alien segment.
I think we had a full 2 commercial breaks and it was still going.
Yep.
On Amazon.
The scene opens with, like, Beethoven music on top of images of Brussels, which is very romantic and nice, I guess. And Stack tells us that Brussels is known as the capital of capitals, an ancient city of charm and elegance.
I want to go there.
Mm. Yes, it made me want to go there, too.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had been there.
Mm-hmm.
Then Stack tells us that there is a contemporary controversy in old world Brussels. Since the fall of 1989, several thousand people from all walks of life have reported that Belgium is being invaded from the skies. So then we've got a lot of interviews with Belgians.
Oh, we love it.
Oh, on the street interviews.
A Belgian townie. Oh, yes. A Belgian street townie.
Yes, honey. I noted that this is the very first time we've ever had street interviews.
Yeah, man.
What
on
do
the
they
street.
Call that again? Something man?
Man, oh, man on the street. Mm-hmm.
Man on the street. We got Belgians on the street, baby. So, and some of them speak English and some of them are not, and they're translating for it, which is cool.
We love it.
Oh, and the people, I mean, it's like truly people on the street because they're not even named.
Yeah.
They'll just like put a thing that says like they saw something or whatever. Mm-hmm. What the Belgians describe having seen is a triangular object in the sky with 3 white lights in the corners and 1 red light in the center. One man describes it as just hanging over the roadway. Another woman describes it as flying very low, just over the rooftops. Then they show us a few drawings, which were, quote, based on the testimony of hundreds of eyewitnesses. And they depict the same object described in the interviews. It's triangular, 3 large lights in the corners, 1 light in the center. July 11th, 1991, an extraordinary press conference was held. High-ranking members of the Belgian military told the media about a UFO which Air Force jets had attempted to chase, and they'd been able to record it on their radar screens. Stack says, "Tonight we will show you the evidence presented at that conference for the first time on American television." So then Stack is more or less like, you guys know how UFO sightings go in America. Usually people see stuff, but the military explains it away or denies that it ever happened. So what he's telling us is to hang on to our butts because this is not the American government and that we're about to have the actual people from the government telling us there's real alien evidence.
The Belgians do it different, baby.
They do. So Stack tells us that this story was filmed with a complete with complete cooperation of the Belgian Air Force and the Gendarmerie, is how it's pronounced. Mm. I wrote it out phonetically.
Nice.
So that's essentially like their police. Mm-hmm. Stack reminds us, Americans, where Belgium is.
Which is also helpful.
Yes. Yes. It's along the southeast edge of the North Sea, bordered by Germany, France, and the Netherlands. Thanks, Stack, because I didn't know exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The mystery began November 29th, 1989, just outside the small town of Yupan, less than 7 miles from the German border. Two officers, gendarmes Henrique Nicole and Huber von Montigue, were on a routine patrol. And then I appreciate they have the reenactment in French with subtitles, and the two officers see something in the sky. They have an interview with Heinrich Nicole of the Yupan Gendarmerie.
Good job.
And he says they were driving along when something caught their eye. They saw a field that was lit up like lights on a football field. So they thought that was weird and pulled over to go check it out. He says there was a huge triangular platform and underneath it, the strong headlights. And in the middle was this blinking, pulsating orange light. The whole thing was floating in the air. So the two immediately call the dispatcher in Yupan, Albert Kreutz. So we have an interview with Kreutz, and he says that they told him they were seeing a strange object in the sky. They said it made no noise. He then says they joked that maybe it was Santa Claus trying to land. But Heinrich is like, no, seriously, though, there's something in the sky. And he tells the dispatcher to call the military and see if they're doing maneuvers. So, great. Like, we're checking. We're seeing what else might be going on.
Gotta.
Kreutz was skeptical but did his job and noted the sighting. So then we have a bigger alien budget as they show the object moving past the car in the reenactment and the gendarmerie officers follow the object towards Yupan. Nicole explains that they could see it easily because of all the lights underneath it. Nicole says they drove slowly because it seemed like it was like someone was inside trying to observe what was happening on Earth.
It's, you know, I've seen that before and it just does seem like that.
It just seems that way.
It seems like I make up this story in my head about what I think they're doing.
Only moments later, Kreutz, the dispatcher, said that lights flashed across the window of his office in Yupan. He looked out the window and saw lights off in the distance, and then suddenly he saw what looked like a laser beam shoot out of the light and come back, and then come back to, like, the main light.
Like it was scanning something.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we're back to Nicole and von Montigue, and they keep following the object, and it seemed like they were, like it was heading toward the forest. Like, it had an intention of where it was going. It wasn't just moving around. It was, like, going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He explains that they saw the laser beam and a ball-like object going out and coming back in from the object like it was trying to measure something.
Mm.
The men call dispatch again, and Kreutz tells them that he had called four local airports, and none of them had reported any unusual activity in the skies. The two men watched the object hover in the sky for about 30 minutes, which to me, like, this one is already more believable than any other ones we've seen on UM, mm-hmm. just because of the sheer length of time they were able to look at what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. Then Nicole says, out of nowhere, another spacecraft appeared over the trees and they were a little frightened, which I don't know if, like, it's lost in translation a little bit, but I thought that was funny. Mm-hmm. The first object was still in the same place and the other was rising up into the sky. As it tilted, they saw that it was another triangle-shaped object with bright headlights in the corners and one in the middle. There was a sort of dome on top with 2 to 3 windows, and a light was on in the inside. By the time they realized what they were looking at, it flew away. So then back to Kreutz, who says that out his office window, he saw a strange machine floating about 500 feet away. He describes that it looked like a large ship floating in the air. He says it drifted there in front of the office for a few seconds, then floated away toward La Calamine. He says it was a beautiful thing to see. Stack tells us that only 6 minutes later, two other gendarmes, I think I'm saying that right, encountered a similar object in the small village of La Calamine, which was just 8 miles north. Gendarme Dieter Plumens says they'd heard their colleagues talking about the object, but they thought it was a joke. Quote, but then we saw something. It wasn't funny anymore. Mm-hmm. He explains they had a strange feeling because they weren't sure what the object was. They thought maybe it was an American airplane or something because they had no other explanation of what it could be. Quote, but it was real and it was above us.
I love it. I love that that's what we're known for is just
Warcraft.
Fucking around.
Spying yeah. in unidentified flying objects. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Ugh, boy. So true. I mean, it could have been anyone's military,
yeah,
but they like, immediately nope. were like, it's the Americans. So anyway, he says, but it was real and it was above us. Plumens says that then they saw the pulsating red light leave the main object and it was descending vertically. It turned to the right and went behind the building. Then, according to the two gendarmes, the craft appeared to morph into a single beam of light and then it disappeared. Stack explains that all four of these sightings occurred within 20 miles and 1 hour of each other. The same day, 11 other gendarmes and more than 100 citizens made similar reports. Stack says that that night in 1989, there's an incredible wave of sightings that continue to this day. He says it may seem unbelievable, but he says when we come back from the commercial break, and there's more segment. he says that when we come back, we'll present startling evidence of the first military tracking of a UFO, a video radar recording provided by the Belgian Air Force, which has never before been seen by the American public.
Exclusive.
Mm-hmm. In April of 1990, a photograph was taken that showed the same arrangement of lights described by the eyewitnesses. And it does look like what they're describing. Stack then says that by using a computer to enhance the film's contrast, the triangular shape becomes clearly visible.
By using Photoshop, we can clearly see the aircraft that we created.
Totally. So they show this, they enhance the contrast, and then this triangle shape pops out, just as the witnesses described. Stack tells us that the photo is currently being analyzed by Belgian scientists, and many believe it's evidence that UFOs are frequenting the Belgian sky. Stack explains that since the sightings, the Belgian military has been inundated with reports of sightings, and the difficult task of deciphering and coordinating the reports has been undertaken by a privately funded organization of scientists and citizens known as SOBEPS. The full name of SOBEPS is in French, so I'm not even going to try. Working with the Belgian military and the gendarmerie, SOBEPS opened up lines of communication and set up procedures anticipating future encounters. Stack tells us they did not have to wait very long. In March of 1990, there was another wave of sightings. Captain Jacques Pinson of the gendarmerie was called to a home outside Brussels. Dinner guests reported a series of strange lights in the sky. So we have an interview with Gendarme Pinson, and he says the lights were bigger, brighter, and a different color than stars. Which I was like, thank you for calling that out, because we definitely would have been like, it's stars. He says the main colors were reddish or yellow and the other colors were green. He says that they were moving around in an erratic manner. Stack says 30 miles away at a NATO tracking station, radar had detected an unknown object at the exact location the dinner guests had reported the lights. It looked like a small circle with a tail. Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Bilen of the NATO radar station says that they phoned other radar sites and they were seeing the same echo in the same place. And so this is where I was getting hooked in.
I'm here for it.
Yeah. But he says it wasn't clear whether it was friendly or enemy or even if it was an aircraft. Once the four other radar stations had confirmed the object, the Belgium Air Force was on alert that something unusual was in their skies. And that to me was like pretty big that like four other places were seeing this thing. So two F-16s were immediately deployed to locate the object, which is just wild. They're like, let's go chase it.
Yeah. Let's go get it.
The pilots were able to find the object with onboard radar, but after 5 seconds, the object bolted out of range at an extremely high speed.
They always do that. They always tend to do that.
I mean, if I was an alien, I wouldn't want them to catch up with me either. Major General W.J.L. de Brouwer of the Belgian Air Force says the acceleration rate they measured it at could not be done by a conventional aircraft. The pilots noted that every time they achieved a lock-on radar, which just means it's like visible in their, you know, the circular radar screen, it's in there. Mm-hmm. Every time they would get it, it would dart out of range. They were not able to accelerate as fast as the object, so they couldn't stay locked on. The footage from the onboard radar astonished the military. So then, which is very cool, they show us the actual footage, the recording from the radar screens, and they show us where the object is on the radar and the area of the screen, which shows us what the altitude of the object is. Mm. So the object was able to rise and drop thousands of feet within seconds, going from 7,000 feet to 10,000 feet in seconds, then down to 500 feet in 5 seconds. Mm. The object was recorded accelerating at 990 knots, which is more than 1,000 miles per hour.
Wow.
Or 1.5 times the speed of sound.
Wow.
That's
just crazy.
That's bananas.
This speed of acceleration and descent would be fatal to a human pilot. The last weird thing, even though the object exceeded the speed of sound, no one on the ground reported hearing a sonic boom. Hmm. So that is also very weird.
Yeah, very weird.
Sorry, Major General de Brouwer tells us that this is all way outside the capabilities of any airplane. So it for sure could not have been that. So despite all the sightings and all the recorded data, there are skeptics who think this is just mass UFO hysteria. Stack says they believe that the radar reports can be attributed to false echoes or changes in atmospheric conditions. Heinrich Nickel says, some people don't believe us and the things we have seen. Well, they are free to not believe us. It doesn't matter to me, but I have seen something, and what else can I say? It was not some invention of my mind. I saw it, and it was very real, and it happened just as I have said. De Brouwer says there have been thousands of observations in Belgium, so it's their job to try and find out if there is really something in the air, where it comes from, what the origin is, and what the intentions are. Indeed, there is something going on in Belgium that is beyond our control. Stack then says that there's one more curious fact worth mentioning. We have endless facts here. He tells us that despite thousands of reports of sightings in Belgium, there's only been a handful of reports of sightings in the neighboring countries of France, Germany, and the Netherlands. So Stack says, of course, skeptics think this is more proof that it's not real. Mm-hmm. But some people think that the objects were drawn to Belgium's highway system, which was very brightly lit at night, so much so that astronauts can see it from the moon.
That's wild.
That's crazy.
I thought that was a really cool point to bring up.
Yeah.
The series of sightings began in November of 1989, and it really peaked with the events that were covered on UM, all of which happened in March of 89. And the reports and sightings ran through April of 1990. Okay. As we know, this is a series of reports of triangular UFOs seen around Belgium. So we do need to get one major thing out of the way right off the bat and talk about that photograph. Oh, I meant to email it to you guys. But do you remember roughly what it looks like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, when I saw it, I was like, I mean, I could see believing it.
Yeah.
Like,
it's in the shape that they said it was
totally.
In.
So this photo was taken in Wallonia, Belgium in 1990. Experts who looked at the photo over the years had issues with it, and then there was really no background in the photo. It's just black. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing else in the photo to give a reference of size or distance from the camera.
Mm, yeah, okay. True.
So they also had an issue with the way the lights show in the photo because it's kind of like our other alien lady a while back with, like, the light snakes, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of like that, where the lights are, like, swooping a little bit and making a tail.
Yeah.
They were explaining that, like, that would have to be, like, a shaking effect, which does not match what eyewitnesses said they saw
in
the sky.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
Okay.
So then, two more things that UM conveniently left out of the segment. The photo didn't come out publicly until 4 months after the alleged event. And over the years, the photo was also able to be recreated using various methods.
Oh.
Some people were using, like, physical things, and then they also had someone doing computer stuff, and they were able to basically recreate the same type of thing.
Okay.
So it's not seeming great for the authenticity of the photo. But for 20 years, SOBEPS, that organization we talked about before, claimed that it was real. But in 2011, a man named Patrick Maréchal came forward to say that the photo was a hoax created by himself. When he was 18, he and some coworkers created the photo, and this was like during the height of the reports from everybody.
Whoa.
Maréchal invited reporters to his home to show them how they had taken a sheet of styrofoam, which they cut into a triangle, painted it black, then stuck flashlights in each corner.
Oh, my God.
They then hung it from a string and took a photo.
Lo-fi.
Maréchal was even able to show them additional photos they took that day, trying to get the perfect photo to make it look believable.
Wow. Okay.
That's a bummer.
Quote, "You can do a lot with a little. We managed to trick everyone with a piece of polystyrene." Another huge point worth mentioning is that most of the reports of sightings did not come until a few months after the most famous ones.
Oh.
So we'll get to that in a second. There was an author named Mark Hallett who wrote an essay criticizing the work of SOBEPs, saying they were spreading misinformation. Hallett seems like our best friend because his theory was that the Belgian UFO wave, which is what this is called, they call it the Belgian UFO wave, was mostly a mass delusion, similar to the idea of mass hysteria, but less hysterical.
More delusional.
He said that the stuff that SOBEPS was putting out there was just fueling the fire for these delusions. We've talked before about the Skeptoid podcast.
Yeah.
It's come up a few times because he often covers these unexplained cases that have been in UM. And the guy that does that podcast is named Brian Dunning, and this was a quote from him. And it said, "Once news coverage leads the public to believe that UFOs may be in the vicinity, there are numerous natural and man-made objects which, especially seen at night, can take on unusual characteristics in the mind of hopeful viewers."
Yep.
"Their UFO reports, in turn, add to the mass excitement, which encourages still more observers to watch for UFOs.
Yeah.
This situation feeds upon itself until such time as the mass media lose interest in the subject, and then the flap quickly runs out of steam."
Mm-hmm. And it's confirmation bias, too. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're looking for it, you're going to find it.
Yeah.
Yes. So my guess of the scenario is that night, probably a few people saw a helicopter or something like that.
Ugh.
It was dark. They couldn't see it clearly. They probably didn't think much of it at the time. But then all these reports come out in the news of people who saw this UFO a while ago. And then they're hearing these Air Force men who saw this UFO a while ago.
Hmm.
And then they think, wait a minute, I saw lights that night too. And then your memory starts filling in holes from something that it didn't actually remember in the first place, using other people's ideas and reports of what it looked like. And pretty soon now you do remember a triangle-shaped UFO.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like your brain puts it together.
Mm-hmm.
And then now you're like, oh, I need to report this thing I saw 3 months ago because for sure it was these UFOs they're talking about. And then a whole bunch of people do the same thing.
Sure.
So Renaud Leclet and company published a writing called The Belgian UFO Wave of 1989 to 1992, a neglected hypothesis. And it said that they did think most of the sightings were just helicopters. They said that strong wind blowing in the right direction or car engines could have easily masked the sound of the helicopters, because that was one thing people were saying was like, I didn't hear it, you know?
Okay.
Other authors also argued that the beginning of the UFO wave was the psychosocial hypothesis, which is the idea that most UFO reports can be explained by other things that we know exist. Celestial objects, airplanes, helicopters, balloons, etc., coupled with, quote, an unusual emotional climate.
Oh, wow.
Weird.
So we've seen that before, too.
Hi, QAnon.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yes.
Totally. Totally.
100. And it also made me think of in Patreon when I did the Mad Gasser.
Yeah.
Because those people were in the middle of a war where gas was being used as a weapon.
Yeah.
So, like, it has to do with what's going on around
Emotions
you,
Emotions are high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Paranoia and fear is high.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what about the radar reports from the military? In the Skeptoid podcast, Brian Dunning talks about this. The pilots never actually saw anything. They just saw the radar locks on their screens. and they saw three of them. And, quote, upon analyzing the data, all three radar locks were on each other.
Oh.
And I don't know exactly what that means.
So the radar locks were actually on the planes that were in the air?
That's kind of how I interpreted it.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure if I'm interpreting it correctly.
So they were, each individual pilot was saying, oh, I see it, I see it. But they were actually seeing another plane that they were in formation with. Oh, God.
That's what I think he's saying. And then the other contacts they made were the result of an atmospheric interference called Bragg scattering. So I definitely looked up and read a lot about Bragg scattering, mm-hmm. but I cannot even begin to explain it to you.
Okay.
It's very complicated, but it has to do with like lattice-shaped radar. It's very complicated, but it is a legit thing that is well known and can happen.
Wow, okay.
So, and then I did find an info in one article on Reuters that said one of the sightings in 1990 could be explained by a Soviet satellite breaking up. I think that was like something happened to it in space and it started
falling apart,
breaking into different pieces. Mm-hmm. Brian Dunning also takes major issue with the fact that all the gendarmerie officers and stuff were interviewed by ufologists who are clearly biased.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and we're probably leading those questions.
Yeah.
And
sure.
I often go back to like in these scenarios, and apparently Brian Dunning has the same theory. Someone saw something.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe the military guys the most because they're aware of more things than most people are aware of.
Mm-hmm.
They saw something.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been a common thing that they just weren't perceiving correctly in the environment they were in.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was something out of the ordinary. Like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if it was the U.S. military doing something weird.
Or Russia. USSR.
Or right someone there. Else's military. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe it even was aliens. I think they saw something. I do not believe that hundreds of other Belgians saw something.
Yeah.
Or if they did, yeah, like I said before, maybe a few people saw a helicopter mm-hmm. and then it spiraled into this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, we have organizations like SOBEPS being like, this is why this is real and people don't know not to believe them and
mm-hmm.
all these things. But there are still people out there who really believe that these were UFOs. This quote was from an article in The Week that was published in March of 2020 saying that 30 years later, we still don't really know what happened, which is true. Mm-hmm. We still don't.
Yeah.
Amand, the colonel who saw the lights with his wife, said, that is a pity because I want to know before dying. Give me a correct explanation of my sighting. That is all I ask. So, yeah, I mean, some major parts of the whole thing have been debunked, but we still don't really know what was out there that night.
Weird.
Could have been an alien.
Could have been an alien. Or several.
We love an alien segment.
I mean, we love a European segment, let's face it.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Yeah. Everybody that was interviewed was really cute.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And very, like, genuine sounding, mm-hmm. which I think is why so many people... there's still in like recent articles, people being like, well, but what about all those people that said all those things?
And right. It's like, you don't think they're outwardly lying.
No.
Yeah. That's true.
And I don't. Yeah. Once again, I believe that you believe.
Yep. I believe that you believe.
Yeah.
Well, good job.
Nice work.
Thanks.
During quarantine, my family and I had to come up with indoor activities to keep us sane. One of the solutions to the endless hours indoors was working on puzzles together. We probably did about one a week, which meant I was always on the hunt for a good puzzle. That's when I found Unidragon. Unidragon wooden puzzles are gorgeously crafted and simply beautiful. Each puzzle piece has its own unique shape, and we're not talking traditional puzzle shapes here. They are so cool. The puzzles also have an incredibly colorful design. They are so gorgeous. Unidragon puzzles make the perfect gift for your partner, kids, friends, and even harder to buy for people like coworkers and extended family. Each puzzle is packed in a premium wooden gift box, and they have a new design released every month, so there are loads of options options to choose from. These puzzles are not your average puzzles. They definitely have a wow factor to them, and they're basically little works of art. It is so hard to choose one, but I went with the fox because my daughter loves foxes and she absolutely loved it. These puzzles are so special. They make an incredible gift, which is why it's so awesome that Unidragon is giving 10% off to Resolve Mysteries listeners. So start checking off your holiday gift list and head over to unidragon.com and use the promo code SOLVED to get 10% off of your purchase. That's unidragon.com, promo code SOLVED for 10% off of your purchase.
From the wilderness of Kodiak Island, Alaska, this is Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier with your host, Robin Bearfield. In a land full of peril and vicious animals, humans are the most dangerous predators of all.
Alaska is a land rich in natural resources. Gold, copper, oil, salmon, and crab have all drawn people to the 49th state in search of wealth. These economic booms have also brought criminals and desperate dreamers to Alaska. In a state with soaring mountains, raging rivers, violent storms, and extreme temperatures, you either choose to live on the edge or society forces you to live there. People disappear in Alaska at twice the national average. Too many have stepped into the woods, never to be seen again. In my podcast, I share stories about murder and mysterious disappearances in the last frontier.
We've all experienced trouble falling asleep, tossing and turning, unable to shut your brain off, staring at the clock, checking your phone constantly. If you struggle with falling asleep, then I have a podcast suggestion for you. It's called Sleep Whispers, and it's 100% gentle whispering of bedtime stories, guided relaxations, and even fun trivia questions and interesting Wikipedia articles. Hosted by Harris, Sleep Whispers is so relaxing and soothing that you can't help but drift off to sleep. With over 800 five-star reviews, Sleep Whispers is your go-to for those sleepless nights. You can search for Sleep Whispers podcast in your podcast player or simply click the link that will be in our show notes. So, the second segment in Season 3, Episode 10 is the story of Robert Hamrick. The segment begins with a drag race, and Stack tells us that in the late 1960s, a motorcycle gang began terrorizing tiny Rock Creek, Ohio. Once a quiet community, Rock Creek became a town held hostage by fear. In the reenactment, they show the gang, and they kind of look like a 60s version of the Sons of Anarchy. Mm. But for some reason, they're talking like the cast of The Sopranos. And I'm like pretty perplexed by it, but I also don't hate it.
It's all over the place.
I kind of like it, and I would definitely watch a show about Sopranos-level bikers.
Sure.
I feel like that'd be fun.
Yeah.
So the former chief of police in Jefferson Village says that they were that the biker gang was involved in fights. They were involved in threats. They pretty much had the entire village under their thumb. And when they spoke, the village pretty much listened.
Village also. So interesting.
And this is the former chief of police saying this. So he was like, bye.
Yeah.
His job anymore.
Too hard. Too scary. Hard.
Not enough pay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Stack says that at the time, the town relied on the Ashtabula County Sheriff's Department for protection. But with the limited resources, the police department seemed unable to stem the crime wave engulfing Rock Creek. They show one of the bikers throwing a beer mug at an elderly man walking by.
Oh.
And I hate that. Like, mm-hmm. if that's really what it was like, if you're just walking down the street and someone throws a glass mug at your head, that is terrorizing.
It's terrible.
Yes. Yeah. So the townspeople decided to fight back, and they organized their own police department, which I didn't know you could do. I didn't know you could just make a police department. But I guess if your town is so small that a group of bikers are terrorizing you, you can just pretty much do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in July of 1969, Robert Hamrick became the third man in less than 6 months to take charge of Rock Creek's police department.
Oh, boy. Mm.
So that's like a new police chief every 7 to 8 weeks. A
lot of turnover.
High turnover rate.
His predecessors both left after allegedly receiving threats from members of the Rock Creek gang.
Oh boy.
But Robert Hamrick was confident that he could clean up the town.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that's a really admirable thing
mm-hmm.
to do. So in the reenactment, I noticed something kind of funny. After the politician, whoever he is, presumably, I guess, the mayor, swears Hamrick in, he says to the reenactment actress playing Hamrick's wife, "Well, go on, give him a kiss."
Yes.
I know.
And it's such a weird thing to say because then she doesn't kiss him. She hugs him because she's just a reenactment actress. She's like, "I'm not kissing this guy."
That's
like,
so weird.
I'm getting like a day rate. She's probably getting $45
a
day.
And also, it's not like they just got married.
No. He's like, "Well, go ahead." It's like he was looking for something to say to like improv.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He did like the most creepy thing.
It's not so good.
And then she like goes in for a hug. It's just very awkward and really funny. So Myrtle Hamrick says that Robert wanted it to be a nice, friendly town, and he wanted to get this gang off of the streets so that people wouldn't have to be afraid of them. Stack says that almost immediately, Chief Hamrick and his family became the targets of a systematic campaign of harassment. Myrtle says that they would do just about anything they could to aggravate Robert when they knew he was home, and then he would get fed up and take off after them. So in the reenactment, they're in front of Robert Hamrick's house, basically like trying to get him to come out and fight. He tries to ignore them and then they speed away. So he jumps in his car and Myrtle's like, "Robert, stop." And he says, "I'm going after them. I gotta go after them." And then she says, like, she implies that while she was worried about Robert, she actually didn't mind because then it would quiet down by her house, because this poor woman is probably a housewife.
That's horrible.
A mother, I think, of three children, if not more. Her husband is being a hero, and you have to respect that. But, you know, she has to deal with the fallout of his heroism, mm-hmm. which is being constantly harassed by a motorcycle gang 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Nightmare.
Like, imagine being her children. And
no.
So Stack says that 5 months after he was sworn in, Chief Hamrick investigated an abandoned building on the edge of town. Inside, he found an expensive sports car. A license plate check revealed that the car was stolen. Gary Martin, a former auxiliary patrolman with the Rock Creek Police, says that they found it and fingerprinted it, the car, and then they bugged the building because they didn't know who had stolen it and who was involved with it.
Mm.
So they put a bug in the building and then a radio in their car, and they just drove around listening until the guys came back.
Oh, whoa, yes.
Because they had to be, because it was 1969. So
and
it was
they
like
don't
a short
have a podcast to listen to, so what else are they going to do?
Well, and also they had to be close by because it was essentially just a shortwave radio.
Yes.
So they had to just drive around in circles so around this funny. Building listening for these people to come
I
back.
I love it.
Yeah. So the guys came back, and he says that when they came back, Bob, Robert, was hiding in the office, and when they came in, they set them up, and Bob jumped out and, quote, busted them.
Mm-hmm.
Stack says the suspects were believed to be members, shockingly, of the Rock Creek Gang. They were arrested, but they were released on bail, which I don't think would happen today if you're a member of a gang that is systematically harassing the chief of police and you get arrested. I don't think they're going to be like, "No, go ahead. Just get right back on that. Just do your thing." Myrtle Hamrick says that shortly after the men were arrested, she and Bob began to get threats on the phone. She says that she doesn't know how many threats they got because if Bob was home, most of the time he answered the phone. But one day she was in the kitchen and the phone rang, and when she answered, a man told her to tell her husband to leave things alone and to get him out of town or he's going to be hurt, and he's going to be hurt badly. Stack says that 1 month later, on March 10th, 1970, Chief Hamrick informed dispatch that he was in pursuit of a car heading west out of town. An hour and a half passed with no further radio contact. Not good.
Mm.
And no one tried to check back in with the police chief who's being harassed and pursuing a car out of town. An hour and a half went by? Okay. So finally, at around 3 a.m., the dispatcher requested that the sheriff's deputies try to find the chief. 4 hours later, Ashtabula Sheriff's deputy, Denny Chapman, discovered Hamrick's patrol car on an isolated road just outside of town. The car had collided with a tree. Hamrick was semi-conscious and barely alive. Chapman says that Hamrick had a really bad head injury and facial injuries all over his face, and that he was surprised to find him still alive. He tried to keep him from moving so he wouldn't further injure himself. Stack says that from the onset, the investigating deputy suspected foul play. They found blood covering the back seat. Hamrick's service revolver and nightstick were missing. Nothing at the scene was consistent with an accident. The lights and the ignition were turned off. Robert Hamrick never regained consciousness, and 10 days later, he died.
Oh, I forgot. He died.
Yeah, 10 days later. It's so sad. Despite evidence to the contrary, Hamrick's death was officially ruled an accident.
Oh, come on.
Ashtabula County Sheriff William Johnson said he never believed all the injuries that Bob received were from a car accident. Myrtle Hamrick says that she believes it wasn't an accident. She believes that he was beaten to death and that it was covered up. Brenda Hamrick Lewis, Myrtle and Bob's daughter, says that there are so many questions and there is evidence, and people have just ignored those questions and that evidence, and they have ignored what was going on in the village at the time. Stack says that 6 hours after the crash, the car that Hamrick had been chasing was found at a local gas station. One of the station employees was known to be a member of the gang. The car was covered in mud and had damage to the front tire. The car belonged to a local woman who had taken it there the day before. She said that when she brought in the car, it was clean and there were no flat tires on the car when she dropped it off. She said that she was surprised when they told her that they would have to keep it overnight. Sheriff William Johnson says that he knew the man at the gas station and had had trouble with him in the past, and he felt like the man was directly involved. Stack tells us that a local woman claims that she heard the members of the Rock Creek gang bragging that they had murdered Chief Hamrick. The woman is interviewed in Shadow, and she says the men were saying that they killed a cop and they got away with it. She says the men said that they beat him in the head and that they had it all planned. She says they set him up. They got him to an isolated road, took his billy club, and started hitting him with it. Then they put him back in his car and left him to die. She says the men said that they'd never get caught, and she knew in her heart, she knew that they were right and that they would never get caught. She says that they were above the law. And as she's speaking, her voice is cracking, and you can tell that she is very upset.
Aww.
Gary Martin says that he's been looking into the case for 20 years, and if someone actually hurt Bob, then he probably knows them and probably calls them a friend because the town is so small.
Ugh.
He says that he'd hate to think that someone he knows, a friend, would leave a man for dead. Chris Hamrick, Bob and Myrtle's son, and at that point I realized that this might be the most amount of talking heads that we've ever seen in a segment.
Yeah.
It's like 13 people.
13 Hamricks.
Says there was no way that it was an accident because he has read the files and there's enough information in there to point out other things. Brenda Hamrick Lewis says that she hopes they find out what actually happened and that those responsible pay for what they did. Sack says that the case of Robert Hamrick has been closed for over 20 years, but authorities are willing to reopen the investigation should any new evidence come to light. And then there is a very abrupt transition and no update.
Yeah.
Stack is at, like, the last sound of the T in light coming out of his mouth, and they're like, anyway, next time. Let's get to the next segment. So this will not be surprising at all because law enforcement has had the case closed for 20 years. This was a member of a large gang, members of a large gang, and it happened in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing.
Why do they have to be so mean? Why couldn't they have been like Sons of Anarchy and gotten, remember how they were like in with the police chief for a while?
Oh, yeah. They paid him off.
The best. He was kind of a sweetie.
Well, I mean, that shows us why there was a new police chief every few weeks because they're calling them and saying, we are going to hurt you if you don't leave.
Yeah, it's scary.
And I think this was sort of like being a volunteer fireman.
Right.
Like, they weren't, no one was paying. It was just people that were like, hey, someone has to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I think, how Hamrick felt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as we see, when there's a case like this, there's just a bunch of people on message boards pointing fingers, naming names, which is not cool. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to do that, but I'm going to just give you some of the things that I found. So basically, there was a group of bikers, and there are about 20 to 30 people in that gang. So obviously, without a deathbed confession, and I'm assuming that many of these people are dead already, we're never going to have a name, yeah. Right? Because it was also probably a group of the people in the group.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So here are some things that people have commented online. Again, definition of speculation, but without it, we wouldn't really have a podcast sometimes. So here we are. So I Googled Rock Creek, and as of the 2010 census, there were 520 residents.
Oh, my goodness.
It is still very small.
Wow.
Okay. One commenter claimed that the son of the mayor at the time was involved in the biker gang and that it was a cover-up.
Oh, that's not good.
Mm-hmm. And astonishingly, when I Googled a list of mayors in Rock Creek, nothing came up because no one knows that Rock Creek exists.
No need to write down who was the mayor.
Yeah. You know what? It's hard to have the full history of a town of 500 people. Another commenter using the title SPKEKDVD claimed that they talked to one of the brothers involved a month after the murder. In short, he said how they got the chief to chase them down a dirt road with another car behind the cruiser at a distance.
Oh, no.
So the car behind the cruiser was actually the one that hit the chief's car and caused him to crash into the tree.
Mm.
And then this man involved went on to say that they all ran up to the car to find the chief dazed or knocked out. They pulled him from the car and started beating him. And then after they put him in the car, and I quote, "We stabbed him once with his antenna from his car."
Ew. God.
Mm-hmm. Another anonymous commenter said, "It's really sad. My father heard members of the gang at the Grand River Manor," I think that was like a bar, "bragging about committing this horrible crime. The suspects supposedly threw the evidence in the river by the manor." And then in 2009, I found a comment from Ken Hamrick, Robert Hamrick's son. He wrote, "I'm Chief Hamrick's other son." So I think there's another young man that was commenting on the message boards as well.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "As the oldest, I was turning 6 when he died."
Aww.
It's no secret who these people were. They even confessed to being pursued. They claimed to have outrun my father and having, quote, "lost him." And then to have gone about their business without returning to do him harm. They did not need to run or hide, as they were never charged. In fact, after the airing of the Unsolved Mysteries episode, the suspects were interviewed again and supposedly passed a polygraph, or so the Ashtabula Sheriff's Department claimed. Headed as it was by the very corporal who participated in the initial investigation in 1970. And then he says, "As for the key, it was decided that the ignition key was struck by his knee during impact, but without any damage to his knee. There were many such strange facts." So remember they said, like, how did he get the car turned off and the lights turned off?
Right.
Oh, right.
So he says, "Right before the TV episode aired in 92, the chief of police of Rock Creek at the time met with us to discuss reopening the case. We warned him to beware of the current sheriff, as we believe the sheriff's department was corrupt at the time of my father's death and covered it up to protect their friends." He also told us that some of those criminals still live in Rock Creek. He said that the tow truck that towed away the wrecked police cruiser was the brother of the driver of the car that was pursued by my father. The current chief also told us that he was investigating suspected voter fraud in the mayoral election, as he suspected that many people who moved out of Rock Creek were voting absentee ballot. Less than a month later, the sheriff and the mayor got together and closed down the Rock Creek Police Department and fired the chief. As far as I know, that was the end of the police department there.
Hmm. So maybe they were in with the police, but just not these police, maybe the sheriffs or whatever.
Yeah. So he says, "Did the sheriff's department cover it up in 70 and 92? Most definitely. But they may have been merely interested in concealing their incompetence and negligence."
Okay. Okay.
And I think that happens a lot. Like, I think people are like, it's a conspiracy and everyone was involved. But I think a lot of times they're just trying to cover up the fact that they didn't do their jobs well.
Yeah.
And then he mentions that no one searched for Hamrick until an hour and a half later.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ken Hamrick goes on to say that he has forgiven these people. He's a very religious man. But he also says, my family, though, doesn't forgive these people. My brother, my sister, and my mother are not as forgiving as I am. And they're pretty mad that I've forgiven these
people. Oh, gosh.
So while I understand the religious forgiveness aspect, I do love that the rest of his family is like, we're not there yet.
Yeah. And we never will be because they suck.
Maybe Christ would have forgiven, but I'm not going to fucking forgive. Yeah. So that's it. That's all I was able to find.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many people did you say in the town?
529 as of 2010.
And it's like, how many people quantifies a gang? You know,
sure.
So like if it's only 500 people in the town, everybody in the town knows somebody in that gang.
Exactly.
There's connections.
Yeah. That's
all
what I was going to say. Yeah. And if that town, if the gang in that town is made up of young men,
mm-hmm.
chances are they are the sons of the people in charge in that town.
Yes.
Right. So it isn't a far cry to think that they were willing to sacrifice the life of Hamrick. And not punish their children who probably did the crime.
And or people were afraid of them because they knew mm-hmm, them and had seen it all firsthand. And
I mean, and then you saw like, oh, this was the mayor's son. Oh, this was the sheriff's deputy's son. Oh, and it probably was.
Yeah.
It probably was.
Mm-hmm.
It's just handled so poorly. Like they, knowing he was under such threat, he never should have been allowed to go out pursuing people alone.
I mean, it seems like it was him and his friend. Gary. It seems like they were the only two police officers. They were probably carrying their own personal guns. They were probably, I mean, they probably paid for their uniforms. There was no infrastructure for a police department in this tiny town.
It's frustrating.
And it's really sad because he and the other three chiefs previously just were doing, trying to do the right thing.
Yeah,
it's a bummer.
Not great. Not great. But good job. But very sad. I feel like we have these police officers that pass away and they have, they're young and they have sweet kids and stuff.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah. Great job.
Great job.
Whoo, mama. We've got a white guy taking money, honey.
That's surprising and new.
Your favorite kind of Seggy to cover.
Yeah, never had this before, ever. It's a new one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we open this segment with some glamorous late 80s wedding photos. You know, the full lace wedding dress.
Yes, honey.
The hair piece. This wedding dress is a turtleneck wedding dress. A lace turtleneck, honey.
You gotta have an itchy lace collar.
So itchy. Can you even imagine? No. So Philip and Kathleen Breen were married in Detroit, Michigan in the spring of 88. Stack tells us that Philip is a dashing, high-powered corporate executive and Kathleen a young, successful businesswoman. And together they enjoyed the good life. They had expensive, what Stack calls grown-up toys, which I
ew, I don't remember
hate.
Saying that.
But I guess you can't call it an adult toy. But I don't want it to be called a grown-up toy.
I don't either.
And then, of course, we see them on their boat truly living it up. And these, quote, grown-up toys were apparently paid for by Philip's investments in the stock market. So for Kathleen, the marriage was a dream come true. And she's a talking head on here, so you know the dream ended somehow.
She's done dreaming.
And she says, there were a lot of things that were really great about him. I think it was his sense of humor being one thing that I thought was really great, and we were crazy about each other. I mean, I really loved this person, and I believed that he really loved me, and I believed that I could trust him. So, like I said, their reenactors are shown boating. They're very flirty with each other, having a wonderful time. Stack tells us that Philip was the president of a highly successful Detroit mortgage company. His position gave him the authority to purchase mortgages for the company. And we see his reenactor doing a whole schmoozy phone call like we've seen before. I feel like they basically used the same script for another schmoozy guy. And a year after their marriage, Philip Breen purchased the Orlando Juice baseball team.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes. Yes.
For $700,000. The team was one of eight franchises in the Senior Professional Baseball Association, which was a new league built around retired ball players, which is kind of nice. Still giving them something to do. Even though baseball players can play a lot longer than other sports.
Other sports with more contact.
Yeah. So this was considered a risky enterprise, but by the end of the year, Philip Breen's investment had ballooned to more than $2 million, so it seemed to work out well. But Kathleen thought the franchise had put extra pressure on her husband. She says, "It seemed like it was something he really wanted to do. It was important to him, but in a lot of ways, I didn't like it because he was just at that point running himself into the ground and it didn't make sense to me." So she's kind of like, we're comfortable. We have enough money. Mm-hmm. We've got all our grown-up toys. Let's enjoy our grown-up toys and not stress ourselves out and work all the time.
Stop saying it.
We had to hear it. We needed to know. So Philip is doing the opposite of what Kathleen would want. And then she becomes concerned about her husband's mental state. There was a recognizable change in his behavior, and he started spending more money, working constantly, and drinking heavily. So back in Detroit, the mortgage company where Philip was employed then made an unsettling discovery. They'd been servicing loans that, this is also, I hate the term servicing used in anything now because sex has ruined that. So they'd been servicing loans that Philip had purchased from companies that did not exist.
Oh, no.
So then the company, of course, suspects Philip of embezzlement. So Philip and Kathleen are on vacation in Florida because they love Florida. They own this baseball team there. They've got this quintessential Florida condo that they're in. She's like, "Let's go to the pool. We're here on vacation." He's taking phone calls, drinking, not actually enjoying their vacation. And when they return home to Detroit from Florida on Friday, January 5th of 1990, Kathleen immediately noticed that something was not right. She said he looked very upset. I mean, he had a very funny expression on his face, and it frightened me to see him freaked out like that. He had records piled all over the floor. So she's like walking into his office at home. Papers strewn all over. That evening, he revealed to me that he had somehow been the victim of people selling phony mortgages. He's the victim. So by Monday morning, Philip convinced Kathleen that he could straighten everything out. He left for work at around 8 o'clock, but he never arrived at the office, and he did not return home. That night, Kathleen discovered that Philip had taken some of his clothes and his luggage from the hallway closet. Not so good. The FBI was brought in to investigate by Philip's mortgage company, and they found that in less than 2 years, Philip Breen had created close to 100 fake mortgages, netting himself more than $10 million.
Oh, wow.
I mean, what a scam. You get all the money, all of it.
Yep.
Mortgages, all of it.
That's crazy.
He had used the money to support his adult toy extravagant lifestyle.
I asked you to stop.
grown-up toy extravagant lifestyle. The FBI also discovered that Philip Breen had been convicted of fraud and embezzlement in Florida 12 years earlier. Kathleen was shocked to learn of her husband's double life, as they always are. On the advice of her attorney, Kathleen Breen filed for divorce, very soon after all of this is discovered. But it wasn't soon enough because the courts held her legally responsible for all of his debts, which is an actual nightmare.
I literally yelled out, that's fucked up when it's I heard that.
It's terrible.
That should not be how that works.
It shouldn't, because unless she is convicted, which she's not a suspect or convicted in it at all, no.
Yep.
So because of that, she was forced to sell nearly everything they owned, their cars, boats, the Florida condo, and their Detroit home. Really terrible.
I just can't imagine that feeling.
And she says, I felt like I was married to a monster from outer space, and it almost sickens me. So, friends, Philip Breen has never been located.
I knew you were going to say that.
So today in 2021, he would be about 75. So he technically could still be alive and living under another name. But of course, I went to Sitcoms Online because you have to.
Got it.
And what I found was someone who, going by the username Purple Clover Michigan, MI, said, number one, among other people commenting, of course. Sure. Number one, Philip Breen was not an alias. I should know, I'm his daughter.
Oh.
The reason, because some people had said maybe Philip Breen wasn't even his real name.
Okay.
I should know, I'm his daughter. The reason I'm not mentioned in the program is because my stepmother, Kathleen, didn't like me or the rest of his family very much. So she did not include me, my mother, my dad's seven brothers, or his parents in the story.
Whoa.
So Kathleen totally left his side of the family out.
Oh, wow. Mm.
Number two, no, he was never caught. However, because he has been missing more than 7 years, he is legally declared dead. Mm-hmm. I doubt anyone is still looking for him. Number three, he did not have his exit strategy planned from the beginning. The only reason he did any of it was because he thought he could get away with it. So she thinks he felt like he was going to be able to live the rest of his life this way, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Number four, he is not a physical threat to anyone. He was never violent ever in his life. Number five, chances are he is dead, but not from suicide, probably from cirrhosis of the liver because he was a huge drinker, but very alert while drunk, which was very weird.
Wow.
So he was probably drinking in the morning at, you know.
A functional alcoholic.
Yes.
Wow.
And then I scroll down a little bit further, and who do I see has responded?
Heather.
But our very own Heather, who's just the truest sweetie, and says, thanks so much for posting and setting some things on this thread straight. I'm sorry for you that he was never found. Is there anything on the UM segment that was incorrect you would like to correct?
Great question.
The ultimate journalist. Yep. She's the best.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is from 2010. So the daughter says, I don't think that there's anything to correct. I haven't seen the episode in a while. I don't think anything said was wrong. Kathleen just left a lot out. Which does seem like she made it all about her and her own loss, which she did suffer a big loss and was totally fooled. But also this guy had a whole other family that was affected too.
A lot of people being left behind.
Yes. And just another case, too, of, like, UM could have. It's not even Kathleen. They could have gone past Kathleen. It's their story. So they also just weren't working that hard to get it. And then just last, I saw on the Unsolved Mysteries fandom comments, someone named Andrea posting in 2018. And they said, I've been reading some of these comments, and I wish they weren't anonymous. I am Philip Breen's daughter from his first marriage. I would love any info anyone may have. You can respond to my comment or email, andrea.breen@ymail.com, and I think she meant gmail.com. But nobody replied to that. So I thought it was interesting that in 2018... So 2010, she's posting on Sitcoms Online, but she's kind of telling people, like, he's most likely dead.
Yeah.
And then 2018, still posting, looking for information. So it's like, just sad. That never goes away.
No.
You don't have answers, so it doesn't go away.
And were some of the comments that were left that she was talking about, were they saying like, oh, I saw him, or oh?
The comments on sitcoms online were mostly speculation, like he was using an alias, things like that. Mm-hmm. Some people thought they were doing some good sleuthing and said, there's a Philip Breen living in Australia. Maybe it's him. Oh, and just like, I think
he probably would have
changed his name.
Yeah.
And also I was going to say before with the family member saying, well, I'm his daughter. That's not a fake name. It might have been a fake name before he was your dad.
That's true.
Right. That's true. Although I think she was saying maybe we know that it wasn't because of his previous how he was convicted of embezzlement in Florida, like 12 years before.
That's true.
If he had been convicted as Philip Breen then.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it wasn't his real name, but it seems like they would have figured that out at that point.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, sad case. I'm glad no one died in this case, but also just leaving a whole family and truly taking people's lives away from them in a different way.
Yeah.
It's really sad. And so fucking selfish.
Yes. It's one thing to discover that your husband or whoever wasn't who he said he was, but then he also ruined your entire life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's the story of Philip Breen.
Mm. Hate him.
We don't like him.
Nope.
Are we ready to share and feel?
Yeah.
I am. I'm ready.
Ooh, do it.
Okay. I have a book.
Ah.
And it is called The Maidens. Did you read it, Allison?
It's on my shelf. I got it from our book club.
Yes. By Alex, I don't know how you say his last name, Michaelides. He wrote The Silent Patient, which a lot of people have read. And The Maidens takes place in England at a college. I think it's Oxford. I've read so many books as of late taking place in England, so I can't remember quite. It's been a while since I finished this one. But it is just a good old psychological thriller, which is my favorite genre, with a female protagonist who's a like psychiatrist counselor trying to figure out what's going on at the school. And there's the maidens, who are sort of this culty following of this one professor. It's really weird.
Oh, cool.
It's good.
Oh, that's on my shelf. I'll read that next. I just finished a book the other night.
Great.
I have a show. It is on Apple TV, Apple Plus. It stars Rose Byrne, and it's called Physical. And it is so good. I'm not going to say a lot about it. It's definitely, if you've ever dealt with an eating disorder, it's very triggering.
Mm.
You know, just use your best judgment and recognize what you're able to handle, because it is very, very triggering.
I want to watch it.
It is. It's so good. It's so relatable. Like, I can't remember the last time I, like, really related to a character. It's funny. It's, like, you know, it's dealing with misogyny, obviously, and politics in the 80s. And it's really, really good. So I highly recommend it. Again, if you struggle with an eating disorder, it's probably not great, but it's very well acted, and I really like it. So, yeah.
Carlin, do you know who Rose Byrne is?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen her, but I don't know.
You know who we're talking about, though, because I didn't realize she was the same person that's in Bridesmaids.
Yeah, she's like the pretty rich friend in Bridesmaids.
And she's from Australia.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. She's Australian. Yeah. She's great.
Okay. Well, Allison recently was talking about the Dr. Death TV show, and I have been listening to season 3 of the Dr. Death podcast.
Oh, me too.
And this season is called Miracle Man, and it's about Dr. Paolo Macchiarini and this woman, Benita, who starts by she's doing a documentary about him, and then it goes from there.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
But they're doing a weird thing where they had like 4 episodes, and then now they're making you wait for the next ones, or you can pay to listen to them now.
Well, you know what I did? I'm paying because I got that Wondery app, baby. And now I can listen to everything all at one time.
Yeah,
and
I'm happy
about it.
Because it's $5 a month. And I was like, our patrons give us $5 a month.
It's my favorite podcast network.
Me too.
Of all time. I love every show they make.
When you pay for it?
What other shows?
All their shows. You get ad-free early.
Oh, ad-free. Okay. Mm-hmm.
But all their shows all at one time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's worth it. That's worth it.
For $5.
I just assumed it was more than $5.
Me too. I did too. And then I looked at it and I was like, oh, really? $5 a month? Okay, take my money. I don't want to wait. And I don't want to listen to ads. Like, I hate listening to ads.
Yeah.
I understand why they have to happen. Everybody has to pay their bills. But if I can give $5 a month and not have to listen to an ad, I am absolutely here for it.
And I truly love it. Every Wondery show I've tried to listen to.
Yeah, me too. It's just worth it.
All right. Well, then you guys are farther ahead than I am.
No, so I'm probably not because I haven't finished it still. I still have 2 episodes to go.
It's funny, though, because it reminded me of the Philip Breen segment with Benita and all of the stories and all of the – I mean, I don't want to ruin
but
it.
She's
but
she's like, such a queen. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And she's so funny, and her group of girlfriends are so funny. They, like – They curse and, they were super involved with whatever was going on and they help her out. And it's just, it's a fantastic story.
It's great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had told the girls in the first 3 minutes, I was enraged. Mm-hmm. Like, if you've listened to the other seasons, you know what's happening, but
what's going to happen. Yeah. It's not going to end well.
No.
And it's just appalling. Mm-hmm. And it's real life.
Mm. All right.
Oh, do we have a review? Are we going to do Review Corner?
Yes. Somebody put one in the doc for me.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't me. So it was the person who does a lot of work. One of the two people.
Okay. We do not have the name of this person, though.
The person's name is Amanda C326.
Love it. And the title is This Started as a Jealous Listen. And they said, so my dream podcast was always this one, recapping and updating UM episodes. Boy, am I glad these ladies started it and not me. They are empathetic, curious, thoughtful, thorough, and hilarious. It is the podcast I wanted to make but never did, and I am hooked.
Aww.
Oh, honey.
So nice.
Don't worry, you had a narrow escape.
Yeah.
Do you want the type of format that makes you have to do the most work?
Do you like your Saturdays, your Friday nights? If you do, don't do it.
Hey. What are we talking about next, Epi?
Oh, my.
Who goes first?
Well,
Carlin.
What are you talking about?
Carlin, what are you talking about, girl?
I'm going to start it off with a Lost Loves. We don't usually start with a Lost Loves.
No, we usually wrap up with...
And we've got a couple Barbaras, Barbara Smith and Barbara Ratner.
You know what they say, the more Barbaras, the better. Then I have the second segment, and it's the unexplained death of Jeffrey Digman.
And I have a special alert, church arsonist.
Oh, yeah.
Florida, baby.
Uh-oh. Yep, and then we wrap it up with the treasure. We haven't had one in a bit.
No, yay.
The Trabuco treasure.
What a name. Maybe Davy Peaches will make an appearance.
Well, you never know where he might be peaching around. All right, everybody. Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you are interested in giving us a little extra support and getting some extra things. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and goodies in the mail. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at resolvemysteriespodcast, on Facebook and Twitter at resolvethepod. And you can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or our P.O. Box, 14005 Portland, Oregon 97293. You know we get really excited about mail. And send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. Tell us about your favorite unsolved mystery, cold case, anything that has to do with anything we've mentioned, we will talk about it. And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review. We might read it on the show. Tell a friend about us. That's a great way for us to get out there. And
For every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's organization is the Wild Bird Fund.
Yay!
Woo woo!
We love you so.
We do.
Bye.
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 One, two, three.
Nice save there, Allison.
I was drinking my drink.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
My bone broth.
Oh, girl.
Yum, yum.